Cultivate Simple, episode 26, Plowing with Pigs.
I'd rather be a farmer. I'd rather work the land. I'd rather see the mountainsides. I'd rather see your hand. I'd rather swim the ocean. I'd rather not pretend.
Welcome to Cultivate Simple, an honest and unrehearsed discussion about trying to live a more simple life. And this is episode 26, and today we're talking about plowing with pigs with Hank. So we have a special guest today. We have Hank Will, and Hank is the... Do you call yourself the editor-in-chief, or is it just editor? What is your title, Hank?
Yeah, you know, it sounds kind of grandiose, but my official title is editor-in-chief.
Ooh.
And what that really means is I get to be in trouble a lot if stuff goes wrong.
So if I call you chief throughout the podcast, is that what you like to be called around the office? Or
no, I would really hate that.
All right. Well, depending on how you act, I might call you chief, and then you'll know what's going on. But Hank is the editor in chief at Grit Magazine, and also a TV star on the TV show Tough Grit, which is a show between Grit Magazine and Tractor Supply Company. And so you can check that out on their website, and we'll talk about that a little more at the end of the podcast, how you can find out more. Susie and I have taken in a few episodes of that, and just really enjoyed seeing you on that show. So why don't we start off by you just telling us a little bit about yourself. And the reason that we have you on the show is obviously because of your new book that just came out, Plowing with Pigs. And I said on the podcast, I think 2 weeks ago, that I think Plowing with Pigs is kind of like homesteading 201. It's not the basic level homesteading talk. So how did you gain all this knowledge? Where did you begin? How did you start homesteading, and who are you? Who are you, Hank Will? Tell us.
If only I knew. It all started a long, long, long time ago, probably 50 or more than 50 years ago. I was born into a seed company and nursery family in Bismarck, North Dakota, and spent some of my early years, doing stuff that they would let a kid do in the fields and in the seed warehouses and whatnot. And I think it was mainly the outdoors that really meant a lot to me, intrigued me. We took a lot of family hikes along the Missouri River. I mean, it was just sort of nature was a big part of our entertainment, as well as the family's business back then. So fast forward many, many years through college and graduate school, and I wound up not being able to go back and work at the family business because they voluntarily liquidated it in the early 60s. Mm-hmm. And so, I was trained to be a college professor, a biology professor, genetics and molecular biology. And so I went to the first job I could get back in the Dakotas after graduate school. I bought myself a small farm and immediately set up a small nursery and a sort of truck farm business, as well as, worked toward earning tenure at Augustana College in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And I think, I was 26 at the time, full of energy, full of ideas, an avid reader. And, one thing led to another. Next thing I knew, I was raising 4,000 free range, and I mean truly free range broilers.
Wow.
Every year. And, I sold them. They were all direct marketed, obviously, back then. It was it was a little bit of a stretch to get them all sold, but at least the first year, but after that there was a waiting list, and one thing led to the next, and eventually I was in a situation, a position to hand tenure back, and, you know, had added cattle to the setup over time, began to write, you know, really to write about the activities that I was engaged in, because I sensed that there was a need for folks to who wish to sort of get back to the land, if you will, mm-hmm. who wish to produce more of their food and stuff. You know, there was a need to try to support them, and that sort of got me hooked into the Ogden Publications family. And once again, you know, serendipity falls my way, and they were looking for somebody to sort of take over the reins at Grit and position it as a good rural lifestyle or country living kind of magazine. And that's really how I got here. Along the way, I've raised, you know, everything from Black Angus cattle to conventional, as well as a number of heirloom breeds of poultry. And we currently do sheep, hogs, and Highland cattle.
Just like a lot of our listeners and a lot of Susie's readers on the blog ask us, how do you have time for it all?
Yeah, no, I can remember early on folks used to ask me that question, and I think my drug of choice is hard work and to be busy. I love being busy, especially if it's something that I'm passionate about. It seems like when I feel passionate, I can tire myself out at in my old age here, but it seems like the energy sort of comes back. And, you know, I don't spend a lot of time watching television. Not that that's a bad thing. I'm just, my entertainment is either, you know, writing, researching, reading, building some new chicken pens, you know, pitching hay to the sheep in the wintertime, mm-hmm. You name it. So do I feel sometimes frazzled? Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely. But really that's what makes me sleep well at night.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's exactly the same way we feel. We've talked about that on the show before, and encouraged people, you know, if you want more time, turn off your television. Mm-hmm. 'Cause that's,
yeah,
we don't, there's a few shows that we watch via, like Amazon or Netflix or something like that. But, yeah, we haven't had TV for, I think, 5 years. I don't know. It, after you don't have it for a while, it just, you kind of forget about it, and mm-hmm. it just doesn't have a place in your life anymore. But that is a huge thing, I think. And that's one of the things I liked about, one of the things that you said in the book was that, going out and, I believe you said it in relation to the poultry, but just going out and watching them run around is kind of your entertainment. And we feel the same way. We just got some ducks recently, and just, you know, watching them play in the yard or watching the chickens run around is pretty good entertainment as it is. So,
no, I agree. Animals doing what they were designed to do. It's fascinating and fun.
When you said 4,000 broilers, that kind of reminds me of what's going on right now, because yeah, we started out. Moving up here to Maine actually was the first time that we had chickens, because we weren't allowed to have them at our last house. Because of our
homeowners association.
Yeah, the homeowners association had rules against it and whatever.
Sure.
So yeah, it's kind of funny because now we inherited some with the house and gained a few more afterwards through some
Craigslist ads.
Yeah, Craigslist searching.
Love it.
Now have
we traded some maple syrup for some ducklings last fall, and now we've got 16 layers coming here in or 12 layers coming in a couple weeks, and our neighbor's hatching out some Delaware chicks for us to raise kind of as broilers, and possibly we'll keep some of the females as layers, and we've got a pair of geese coming and a dozen more ducklings coming. Yeah.
Oh, this is awesome.
So when you said 4,000, I kind of looked over at Susie and, like, as in a don't get any ideas kind of way. but that's how it starts, right? I mean, that's...
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if you've heard, but we're, and this is kind of an announcement in the same way, but we're doing this thing called the 5x5 challenge, and encouraging people to start their own garden. It's at 5x5challenge.com. And what we're saying is start out with a 5x5 plot. And there's a seed packet from Renee's Gardens that is five varieties. And it's, you know, five pretty common things that everybody can grow. But that's, we're just encouraging people to start because that's where it does begin. And I like that you said that, you know, that they wanted, when you were hired at Grit, that they wanted to position it as a publication to help people who want to grow more of their own food and do that kind of thing. How long have you been at Grit?
Oh gosh, let's see. I think I've just been here a little over six years. I came I came officially April of whatever year that would be, 07. Mm-hmm. But I was their freelance technical editor probably for almost a year prior to that. Once mm-hmm. they, with the first issue that they switched it over from the newspaper format to the glossy magazine format.
What types of changes have you seen in kind of the articles that you're producing? What changes have you seen in homesteading or in you know, rural living over that time period? Do you think that it's becoming more popular and more sort of mainstream, or
no doubt and I don't know if this is real, but in my mind I think it's becoming much more mainstream. I think the concept of sort of taking charge of one's food supply is always comforting when, you know, the economy sort of becomes shaky. Mm-hmm. And I think it sticks for a long time. And I think one of the things that I've been most gratified to see is that the backyard, you know, the backyard vegetable production has always been strong. It's grown stronger, but backyard poultry has just utterly exploded. And I would say the mushroom cloud, you know, has barely expanded out. I suspect growth, that we'll see lots of growth there for the next quite a few years. And my prediction is that after that, you know, we'll see a lot of push for backyard, you know, sheep and goats, probably next. I think, you know, rabbits are always there too, but I think as folks have success, you know, growing really good, wholesome vegetables and fruits for themselves, you know, I think naturally you turn to, eggs. And, you know, where possible and where the squeamish factor is managed well enough, then to meat. And I think that's a big jump for a lot of folks. Mm-hmm. It's different to steal an egg from a hen every day. You know, it's a little bit different to cut her throat and have her, you know what I mean? And feel her lifeblood drain.
Yeah.
Right. Especially if you've never been exposed to that, I think.
Right. Right. And I've done, I can't tell you how many chickens I've butchered in my life, but it's still the most, it's a very serious, somber kind of day when it's slaughter day, because you never get, at least I've never gotten, you know, I've never gotten so used to it that I don't care. Right. I guess it's really what.
That's one of the reasons I always encourage people to partake in that or to go somewhere and watch it happen at least once. Though, even if you don't plan on doing it yourself, because Brian's a hunter, and well, he processes some of the small game. We take the deer in, you know, to a small local butcher to do it for us. But I think it's important for everybody to kind of experience that, just so you know the value of what you're doing, and really give kind of meat the respect that it needs, and you're not as wasteful of it and stuff when you know where it's coming from and what actually has happened. It's not like some weird things that happens behind a curtain, you know, that you are completely not familiar with.
Right. No, and I think that's huge. I think that's a really important piece to our food consuming puzzle. You know, I think anybody that eats meat should really have been once at least up close and personal with at least a humane process, a humane version of the process. Mm-hmm. Cuz it's sobering.
Yeah.
It is. That's I think on the podcast episode that we did where we talked about hunting, I talked about the first deer that I ever killed, and just about that, the thankfulness that I felt towards the deer, you know, saying, I mean, even saying out loud, thanks for providing meat for my family, you know, for the next 6 months. I mean, it just really is a, it does make you appreciate your food, but I think that that's also true for growing your own vegetables too. I mean, you know,
sure.
When you're out there planting the seed and spending that time and, you know, watering it and watching over it and keeping the, you know, pests or the deer away from it. You know, it makes you appreciate when you have a salad, or we talked a couple weeks ago about maple syrup, you know, I mean, something as simple as that. When you put the time into it, you know, we had a friend that came over for some pancakes, you know, with real maple syrup, and he left a little puddle on his plate. And I, you know, quickly told him, hey, you're going to lick that plate off because, you know,
totally.
That represents like 20 minutes worth of work right there.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. So, it changes the paradigm, you know?
It does.
It does. Definitely. And we talk about that, cultivating a mindful life and living a little more mindfully. And I think being engaged in a lot of the processes about acquiring your own food and all of that really helps kind of cultivate that mindfulness that has kind of been lost, I think. But I think that's something that people are really searching for. It's like this void that they feel.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with you completely. And I think cheap food is one of the problems.
Oh, yeah. Yep, I completely agree as well. People don't value it because it's cheap.
Right.
Well, you don't have to do anything for it. It's just like anything else. If you don't have to work for something, then you don't appreciate it.
Right.
So, you know, whether that be money, food, or anything. I mean, if
Yep.
So
yeah, it transcends.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit, you mentioned a little bit about your current farm. What do you currently have growing and living and roaming around?
Yeah. Okay. So currently we have some of the hogs, they're mulefoot pigs. It's just an interesting heirloom breed that thrives outdoors. Good mothers. They tend to make nests out of piles of sticks and hay. And so we've had some sows that have had babies at, you know, 16 degrees.
Wow.
And you don't see anybody, you don't see anything but her nose poking out of a pile of hay. And, you know, 3 weeks later, there's 8 or 9 little ones romping around in the snow. And, you know, so again, an animal that's, you know, an animal that knows how to do it without you sort of micromanaging every step of the way.
Right.
And then, you know, I always fancied myself a cattle guy, and we raised Black Angus once in a fairly, you know, we had a fairly large herd, around 150 head. And, you know, it was fun, it was interesting, and I learned how to do some pretty intensive pasture management, you know, rotational management. Mm-hmm. We called it management intensive grazing back then, and really managed to improve the grassland matrix and the organic matter of the soil. So I had, that was sort of my big turn on to the power of ungulates, basically, for land improvement, really.
Mm-hmm.
But I always, you know, I think monocolor, not, and monoculture too, but monocolor is really boring.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep. I think one of the beauties of domesticated animals and even wild critters is variability,
mm-hmm.
you know, diversity, if you will. And so I always thought that the Highland cattle really looked cool because they looked a little bit prehistoric, and they reminded me, you know, their shaggy coats reminded me a little bit of bison. And so when I moved to Kansas, I decided I was going to do what I wanted to do for fun, and I'm doing hand quotes for fun, you know, in spite of the fact that I couldn't sell them on the commodity, you know, or at the sale barn, you know, I would get docked for horns and for not black, not short haired critters. And I said, you know, I don't really care. I want to grow something that's going to make me pleased. And what we discovered was that the meat is it finishes out on grass beautifully. It's fine grained, it's delicate, and incredibly tasty. And if we get it in folks' hands, they clamor for more. Mm-hmm. So that worked out. And then a friend of mine convinced me finally to add some sheep. And I would say that they're absolutely my favorite animals to raise. So we have it's a flock of mainly Katahdin. And when I say that mainly, I mean the genetics are probably about 95% Katahdin, maybe. There's a little bit of the name goes out of my head. Shoot. It's a relative of a wild European sheep. Mm-hmm. They have curved horns. I select for no horns, mm-hmm. but they're really thrifty. Maybe it'll come to me later. And it's a small proportion of our genetics. And then we've got a little bit of one of our best rams was, you know, 1/8 that genetic line. Mm. And so they're a hair breed. They still shed, and we raise them and market the lambs for meat. And in this particular case, we simply sell them as live animals. We'll deliver them to the local locker, mm-hmm. and folks can have them cut however they want. And we also allow some folks to accommodate some folks cultural views and allow them to come out to the farm and kill and cut their own, mm-hmm. According to their traditions.
Right. Yeah.
So we do that. And then, we grow a pretty big food garden, for ourselves. And this year I managed to obtain, it must be, nearly 40 varieties that my great-grandfather offered in his seed catalog in about 1907, mostly sort of corns that I would call Indian corns, mm-hmm. is as politically incorrect as that might be, because that's what we always called them. Mm-hmm. But mostly corns that he collected, that actually he was given by members of the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara tribes, mm-hmm. up in the Dakotas.
Well, I'd say you can call them Indian corns at that point.
Yeah, totally. So I've already planted some of the most cold hardy, you know, here it is April, 9th, and mm-hmm. and it's really not corn planting time in Kansas, or our part of Kansas, quite yet, probably a couple weeks off. But I put in 49 hills over the weekend. These are social corns, most of them. They like to grow in hills. They like to touch one another, you know, maybe 5 to 6 plants in an 18-inch diameter hill. Mm-hmm. 18 inches at the top. They're more like little plateaus, really. Mm-hmm. But so we'll see where that leads. I've had a tendency in my life to just follow paths as they became apparent to me. And this is a great sort of uplifting connection to my ancestors and many of the friends that helped sustain them when they first stumbled out into Dakota territory in the late 1800s. Hmm.
And I think you mentioned in the book, you also, I know that in the past you have raised rabbits. Do you do that currently or?
No. We just did that in passing, really, mm-hmm. when the children, looking for 4-H projects and those kinds of things.
Right.
Yeah. So the only other, obviously I forgot to mention the poultry. We do keep mm-hmm. a good laying flock and we'll raise, around 50, broilers a year to put away. And, some of them will sell. And then, let's see, what else do we have? We have some geese, which we use to weed some of the patches, especially the corn patches. Mm-hmm. And a small flock of ducks that we actually took off of somebody's hands last fall, strictly because they were getting really, really up in years and didn't want to brave the ice in the wintertime to keep them fed and watered. So, mm-hmm. and they're a blast, man. Ducks are a blast.
Oh, we love our ducks.
yeah, yeah, Yeah. They're comical. They're great entertainment.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I utterly adore seared duck breast. So.
Oh yeah. We're just about to the point. We have two males that we need to slaughter. So I'm kind of looking forward to trying it. And I asked about rabbits because I'm getting some silver foxes, hopefully in May, and I'm going to start breeding those for meat. Because
right, and for pet food, because our pets do a raw food kind of natural prey kind of diet. So
yeah, that's a great idea.
Go a long way for feeding the dog.
Yes.
Oh,
she tends she tends to get expensive, and we don't get much work out of her. So I don't. I still haven't figured out why we keep her around. But
we love our dogs.
For your sheep, do you have like a livestock guardian dog, or how do you protect them?
He has got donkeys.
Donkeys. Yeah. That's right.
I'm always commenting on his pictures on Facebook because I've been trying to talk Brian into a donkey since we got up here.
Oh, I got to tell you about donkeys. I mean, donkeys, first of all, our donkeys are just, you know, they put the harassment to the local coyote population, and mm-hmm. we have a lot of coyotes. And they're actually hard on our dogs too. If they're out roaming around without us along, if mm-hmm. the dogs stick pretty close to us when we're out hiking, everything's pretty cool. But the donkeys, I got to tell you, the donkeys are just a source of constant joy for us because they're naturally predisposed to liking the company of people mm-hmm. and they're self-sufficient. I mean, they make a living on the brown, dry grass, even when there's green grass to graze. They get fat and slick on it. And I mean, our standard-sized donkeys, which is the types that we have, they're heavy enough also that they don't need their hoofs trimmed. You know, they mm-hmm. self-trim. I mean, I was hesitant to get any equine at the very beginning, until somebody, of course, you know, strong-armed me and talked me into it. But in terms of maintenance, it's the lowest maintenance animal that I've ever, pretty much that I've ever experienced. They seem to thrive, certainly in our conditions anyway.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Yeah. So there's a plug for you.
Thanks, Hank. Gee.
Yeah. I think donkeys would be the next thing you should probably get.
Hank, I'm sorry, the connection's breaking up. I'm afraid the interview's over.
We've definitely thought about donkeys and sheep as kind of our sheep for sure. Kind of, I think, is our first introduction into animals. We've got, you know, some pasture land here. It's not, I don't think it's great enough to support like a dairy cow or something, but it'd be good for sheep until they help improve it. And then maybe a cow in the future. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. I think sheep are just kind of a fun, and I would say relatively non-intimidating, at least in terms of size, you know, mm-hmm. Grazing animal to try. And I think they're not quite as vexing as goats. I mean, we used to keep goats to clear the rogue, multiflora rows that would creep out into our pastures, but they did such a great job of eradicating it that we don't have to keep goats anymore. Mm-hmm. And when I say keep, I mean that sort of loosely, because boy, they can find every malfunction in your fencing in a heartbeat, and then they'll be, you know, walking around on the hood of your truck or something.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
Yeah. Some of the people I follow on Facebook they got goats this past year, and that's been their experience as well, that they'll, if there's a way to get out, they will get out.
They said
it's not even like they want to do anything when they get out. They just don't want to be in.
They're like
whatever
cats.
It is.
That's exactly how cats are.
Yeah.
No, that makes total sense. It's kind of like, if I can be out there, it would be more interesting, or I'm free, or, you know, we had one that would often be at the back door in the morning. I'd go out to go do chores and I'd open the door and go out, and it was a pygmy goat. And heck, he'd be halfway in before I'd even figure out that he was there. But, you know, we loved them nonetheless. They were a great entertainment and did good work for us too. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about the book then, because a lot of the ideas in the book kind of go along with what we're talking about here. First of all, tell us a little bit about how your book Plowing with Pigs came about.
Oh, you know, it was just one of those being in the right place at the right time situations, I think, you know.
You have a lot of that. it seems.
Yeah, you know, I can't describe it, you know, entirely, but it just seems like opportunities kind of just dropped in front of me, and either I had enough sense or, yeah, maybe I had I didn't have enough sense to say, I'm going to check that out. I'm going to follow that path.
Let me think about that.
Yeah. But I was on the Mother Earth News Fair circuit. You know, it's another division of our company, and I was my talk was about using animals for taking advantage of an animal's sort of biology to do hard labor for you around the homestead or the farm. Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the first animals that I like to open my talk with was basically the rooting behavior of hogs. And instead of, you know, believing that the instant you bought hogs, you had to wring them or worse yet, cut their snout so that they couldn't root, you know, it was kind of like our ancestors used to put that stuff to good work. Why couldn't we put it to good use today? And, you know, as it turns out, I can't think of an animal that could better open up a sod land for garden space or even field space, because they'll not only turn the ground, but they'll, you know, glean roots and grubs and whatnot, and actually leave you with fairly clean soil, mm-hmm. plus a little bit of fertilizer to boot, plus right. they'll gain some weight on it. And
you get bacon. You know,
exactly. Exactly. You get the work done, plus you get a reward. You know what I mean? So
that sounds like a no-lose situation.
Yeah. And so it just happened that an acquisitions editor from New Society Press was in the audience at one of these talks. And she hung back. You know how folks don't want to ask their questions in public, and, mm-hmm. and there's always a line up after your talk. And she waited for about a half hour while I answered folks' various questions off to the side. And then she told me what she was about, and she basically asked me if I'd ever thought about, you know, putting that stuff down, you know, in an organized fashion in a book. And it turned out that we had thought about it. You know, Karen and I had talked about, you know, we should do a book. We'd each done books before. She had done a cookbook, and I had done a bunch of machinery books by then. And one thing led to another, and I thought it would be fun. It's fun to have a book project to kind of tide you through those winter months when there's not a lot you can do outside.
Right.
And you feel like you're twiddling your thumbs or whatever. Or in my case, it's too cold in the workshop or the engine shop, you know, for me to work on machines and stuff. So we did that. That's actually how it happened. You have to, you know, there's quite a process for getting it vetted and approved, but it's a great process. I think it's fun, you know, building the outlines, building the table of contents, really kind of formulating in your head and on paper all the way you want to kind of pull the project together. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so and Karen and I work really, really well together. We enjoy actually working with each other and complement each other in so many ways that, you know, it was a no-brainer to try to do it together, because mm-hmm. there's a lot of stuff that she does that I don't do, like her home-based baking business that, you know, we kind of wanted to include. I mean, we not mm-hmm. kind of, we really wanted to include.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess we should mention that your wife, Karen, co-wrote the book with you. And right. I wanted to read the full title, because it can be a tad misleading.
Right.
Plowing with Pigs and Other Creative Low-Budget Homesteading Solutions. Because when Susie first told me, oh, you know, Hank and his wife are coming out with a book, it's called Plowing with Pigs. And she had talked about that before. Susie's the type of person that if she has an interest in something, she'll get, you know, 10 books from the library and plow through them all. And then, you know,
I love it. I love it.
So she can carry on conversations with anybody about anything. But yeah, so she had already told me probably about a year ago about how, you know, how fascinating it was that pigs can root up trees and all this stuff. And I was like, oh yeah, that's really cool. Yeah. but, you know, of course, when I start talking about website code, she rolls her eyes and glazes sure, over. Sure. But when I saw the title of the book, I thought, oh, okay, well, that's a pretty thick book talking about plowing with pigs. Right. But then once I got into it, obviously, like I said, I feel like it's a homesteading 201 book. Most of the books that you see that are, you know, talking about homesteading or about the different components of having animals or growing your own food, they seem very basic. It's kind of a starter mm-hmm. course where sure. I really feel like your book was more, it was kind of that next level. It's like, all right, you started and you've got a few things going. Now what's next? What can you do to, you know, really dive into it deeply? Is that kind of what you intended with the book, or?
Yeah, no, that was totally our goal. You know, the goal was to say, you can get all the information you need to learn how to raise pigs or raise cattle or raise sheep. You know, there are, thousands and thousands of pages in really good books to help you with that. But what we wanted to do was to say, okay, you're comfortable now with the animals, but you're comfortable now enough with the critters. What else can you do besides kind of raise them in a conventional way? Mm-hmm. And then we sort of stretched from there into, what other kind of natural resources do people typically look at around their place as, you know, weeds and eyesore, or gee whiz, that fence line is overgrown with trees. And you know, Karen and I, we just look at all that stuff as resource. I mean, yeah, we sometimes wish the fence line was clean, right? But why, when you really think about it, why? Mm-hmm. It provides wildlife habitat. It provides shade for your own animals and it blocks the wind. But we have this sort of neatness gene in at least the American human species, mm-hmm. or that variety. So you know, that's really where we were going with this, was to say, okay, you've got some certain basic skills. Maybe you're still developing those skills, but here's some kind of more somewhat novel. They're not really novel because most of this has been done before. Mm-hmm. But here's some novel ways that you can put those skills to sort of an added value level of work for you and satisfaction.
Yeah, that's great. This was my favorite quote from the book when I was reading along. When you said, when homesteading, it's important to avoid allowing rules to handicap your progress. And that's what I always tell people, because it's so easy to read through tons of books and have this idea of how things are supposed to go. And unless you're willing to kind of go with the flow.
Right.
No. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's huge. That's huge. I think in terms of proselytizing, especially, it's like folks can get completely bound up by one of the rules that they don't think that they can meet. And so they scrap the whole project. And, you know, rules are just really a way of laying out complex processes in ways that maybe beginners can really understand. And I think, you know, there are an infinite number of ways mm-hmm. of being a proper animal husband for various breeds, and everybody's situation and environment and whatever is, you know, sort of dictates how you need to be able to flex and make some of those decisions for yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, I find that really interesting. I was reading a book about feeding poultry because I've been trying to work into buying local grains and mixing up my own feed for our chickens and allowing them to run around and be chickens and get yeah. some of their own food, you know, because they, totally, you totally. Know, they know what they need. And yep. it's interesting because one of the books I read was saying that, you know, other than amusement, you know, you're letting your chickens run around your yard provides no nutritional value whatsoever.
Yeah, so then I wonder why they chase, you know, in my country, why do they so vigorously chase down grasshoppers? You know?
Mm-hmm,
you know
exactly. What I'm saying? Yeah.
It's just they're just entertaining themselves.
That's
come
right.
on.
Yeah.
No nutritional
yeah.
value.
Don't
but I
silly.
Noticed that the feed consumption is down by about half since spring came and the grass greened up and they're out running around. So I mean, it saves me money and I know they're healthier. So
Absolutely.
Bending the rules sometimes is good.
Oh, totally, totally. I mean, there's a rule that we break, that I've broken actually since I was quite young, and that is, you know, you can't raise turkeys in the vicinity of chickens mm-hmm. because, and...
What's it called?
And I,
like
and I had read that. Something. I had read that for sure, and I just, some turkeys came my way, and I didn't have, you know, means to keep them mm-hmm. separated. And, you know, so for almost 40 years, I brood them together. They even run in some of the same poultry yards.
Mm-hmm.
And gosh, no disasters.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a lot of friends that do turkeys and chickens and geese and ducks all together in like their farmyard and everything does all right. I mean, I figure the wild turkeys around here run right through our chicken where our chickens forage and I don't see them dropping like flies. So.
No, totally. You know, and if you've the way you're raising them, they're not in a stressed environment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I assume if we had, you know, a confinement turkey house
right
and a confinement chicken house, we wouldn't want those things to be mixing and mingling, but mm-hmm. that's a different story.
Right. So in the first part of the book, you talk about animals and we've been talking about that a little bit. And then in the second section, you talk about the title of it is The Bounty in the Woodlot and Hedgerow, which you mentioned a little bit. But I do want to thank you because one of the cooler tools/toys that I have was originally inspired by you getting your chainsaw mill. And
oh, cool.
Yeah. I don't know even when that was probably about 2 years ago for me. And Susie pointed it out and said, oh, you know, check this thing out. You can make your own lumber from wood.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
And so I actually, you know, I didn't have a chainsaw at the time. And so I said, well, you know, if I'm gonna get this chainsaw mill, I need something to put in it, like a chainsaw. So ended up getting the 2-for-1 deal there. But yeah, we had some trees that we took down back in Ohio at our house. And there was a maple, an oak, and a cherry. And all of them were probably... I know that the oak and the cherry were close to 80 years old. So just huge, beautiful trees and really straight.
Wow.
So we wanted to, when we started coming up with the idea of moving to Maine, we wanted to mill some of that wood and take it with us. And so, yeah, I ended up getting the Alaskan mill and a chainsaw and milling up that wood. And it's sitting up in our garage right now. It's some of it's, you know, 1.5-2 inches thick. So I'm still letting it dry naturally a little bit.
Right,
But totally excited about that. And then you talked about that in the book. About milling your own lumber and different projects that you've done with that. And then you also talked about another small type of mill that you got as a trial, I guess.
Right, with the magazine, yeah.
Yeah. Talk about how you got into that. Like, what first gave you the idea? And there's a lot of things in the book about, and in this section of the book, about building your own tools, just being creative with the things around you. Where do you get your inspiration for those things?
Oh, you know, I think, again, I've always loved working with my hands, even as a young kid, and I still have some scars in my fingers from some early encounters with sharp things. But and hand tools to me are just a joy to work, especially if they're old hand tools where the handles are already sort of sweat stained or, mm-hmm. or oil stained or whatever they might be. But I went through a phase in my life where I built traditional wooden boats. It was actually when I was in graduate school back in the mid to late 70s. And I really honed my skills with hand planes and adzes and any number of, you know, slicks and hatchets and axes for shaping timbers basically into planks mm-hmm. and then, you know, getting them to bend the ways that you wanted them to bend and whatnot. And of course, you know, when you're in school in Chicago, finding wood is raw material is always difficult. And at that time, they were cutting down still huge American elms.
Mm-hmm.
And I managed to score from a foundry that was being torn down a gigantic 36-inch throat depth bandsaw.
Wow.
Which I could drag home. I had to drag it home in three pieces because it was too heavy for my pickup truck. I'm not kidding you. I think it was about 1,200 pounds.
Jeez.
And it was a little pickup truck. But so I'd scavenge up as much of that elm as I could. And because the park district or the park department would cut the trees down and then just leave these huge long logs by the side of the road, and the sanitation department would come and pick them up.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I was supposed to or not, you know, but I did. I took as many as I could, and I resawed them on that bandsaw mill. You know, I had like a 5-horsepower electric motor hooked up to it. I had to run some wiring to make it run. it was hilarious. But anyway, so, you know, I was always like in the back of my mind, you know, all of that stuff, if you like to work with wood at all, you realize that it all comes from something like that, those trees that were being downed. And mind you, I don't recommend trying to do all kinds of intricate work with elm. Its grain goes every which way. And that's part of the reason why it's difficult to split. But,
mm-hmm.
but so, you know, fast forward again, you know, through various phases of my life, anytime we had an opportunity to take sort of that kind of a resource, you know, that takes quite a while to grow.
Mm-hmm.
We always look for ways to put it to some sort of use other than, or in addition to using it as fuel, of course.
Right.
And one of my favorite hand tools, is the fro.
Mm-hmm.
And I happen to have I found it at a junk shop. I don't think the person even knew what it was, but it's a very old hand forged fro, and I don't use them to make shingles. I use them basically to split out boards or planks or to shape things, you know, for making hay rakes or gates. I love making sort of rustic gates.
Mm-hmm.
using split Osage orange, you know, and then traditional kind of mortise and tenon construction, and they last, you know, that they last and the sheep, you know, that sheep, if they can't stick their heads through, they don't push on them.
Mm-hmm.
I have I need to send you a video clip. I don't know, I posted it on Facebook, so I'm not sure if you saw it come through, but we have a store about 5 miles from us called Liberty Tool, and it's known all over this area, but the guy goes out to auctions and different places. I don't know where he finds some of the stuff that he does, but Hank, I honestly think that you could probably spend about 3 days on the first floor of this store, because it is just wall-to-wall, floor-to-ceiling, old tools.
Oh my gosh, and that'd be like heaven.
It is. I'll have to send you the video clip. There's a video that is on Vimeo that somebody had made about it, and it is. I haven't used hand tools a lot, and I want to get into working with them, but I don't. I mean, I go in there, and there's so much that I don't know what there is in there. You know, I don't know to look for the different quality items. Susie's been finding shovels and different, you know, garden tools like that in there, and it's all reasonably cheap.
Oh, it's like $3 for a shovel that has a beautiful handle, and I mean, just made in the USA back probably in the 40s or the 50s. And you know, for $3, I buy a shovel at the hardware store and I wear it out in a couple of years, where I buy this and it's gonna last, you know, it's going to be around when I'm gone. So
no, totally. It's heirloom quality stuff, mm-hmm. you know,
but like hand planes, this place must have probably 300 hand planes.
Oh gosh.
Of
yes.
various sizes and lengths and shapes. And, and when I look at them again, I don't know a ton about them. But they all look like great quality, and I'm kind of like, geez, I need to buy a couple of these things to, you know, but I don't know what I don't know. I just need to expand my knowledge or find a mentor. But another cool thing And I guess I'm just bragging now, but next weekend, I'm actually going to a workshop on timber framing. There's a couple guys up here that teach workshops on it. And so there's a couple buildings that we would like to put in. And with our land now and having, you know, the resource that we do in the woodlot, we would like to put up a couple, not kind of like garage type structures, mm-hmm. or even the chicken coop really needs redone, you know, a timber frame chicken coop. How about that?
It'll last for 300 years. Oh, God, that would be awesome.
So
that'd be a great project to learn, you know, to sort of hone your skills on.
Yeah.
Because the chickens don't care if it's a little askew.
Right. Oh, but with Brian on it, it wouldn't be askew. Well,
we'll see. We will see. But, another thing that I liked about the book is that you say, because this is something that I'm always telling people, is that, and you even have a section about the gym membership that pays for itself. That's one of the things I think that is rewarding. We talked about this a little bit earlier in the podcast, but about doing the work yourself is that you're getting something out of it. You know, you're putting a lot of effort into the different things that you do, but there's a definite reward at the end. That's not just the thing that's produced, but the satisfaction of producing it yourself. And it sounds like Susie and I keep looking at each other as you're talking, you know, people probably do with us sometimes too, but you know, you're talking along and I was into boat building back and it's just, it's funny all the different things that you've been involved with. And,
we get the same looks when we talk to our normal urban friends about how we're sugaring our maples, and they kind of look at us like, huh?
Yeah.
Think
of
that.
Why would you do that?
Exactly.
is that even a thing?
Right.
Until we give them maple syrup and then they want to sugar their own maples. So.
Yeah. I think people just don't get that's really where stuff comes from, you know?
Mm-hmm. And there's inherent joy. And I think we've talked about this before, particularly in the podcast we did about sugaring, that when you, part of a product is the process. And when you buy something at the store, you're missing out on so much of the experience that comes along with it. You know, when you think about maple syrup, you're not going out in February or March, you know, your first forays out into the sunshine after a long winter, and you're, you know, looking at the maple trees and you're tapping them and you're collecting sap and boiling it down. I mean, there is just an amazing amount of joy that comes from that process and getting outside, and you know, the syrup tastes so much sweeter, and you miss out on so much when you're not taking like a firsthand role in the procurement and the even making bread from flour that you buy from the store.
Right.
Is so much more enjoyable than buying a loaf of bread somewhere.
No, I agree. I agree with you totally.
So tell us a little bit, because the last section of the book is all about, basically, you mentioned it earlier in the podcast, but about Karen's home business and how to,
which I think, yeah, this
do
is
something
really great
from home,
because Brian and I are both self-employed. We both work from home, and people are always asking us like, what can I do? How can I start my own business to work at home? And I think this is kind of a great primer for starting like a home-based kind of a food business, because it's so, I mean, farmers markets are popping up everywhere, and the local food, homemade kind of thing is getting really popular. So there's no better time than now to start a business like this. I think you can really be fairly successful with a few if you do it right.
And one thing that you mentioned earlier, I believe when you were talking about selling poultry and going direct to customer, and that's what you talk about in the book. And I really think that that's a good idea. Why do you think that that has worked well for you over, you know, selling to a big grocery store or something like that?
Yeah, no, that's a really great question and an easy one to answer. And it really speaks to why Karen's done her bread business or baking business the way she has. You lose all kinds of risk, financial, labor, you name it, if you make things to order. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we all took, Karen and I have taken many chances in the first sort of iterations of some of our projects because we believed in it. You know, we might start a project with, you know, 10 customers, but, you know, it's just as easy to grow 1,000 as it is to grow 100 broilers or, you mm-hmm. know, something like that. Maybe.
That's
maybe
right. That's what I keep telling Brian. He's not a believer yet.
You know, within reason. But you know, there are some economies of scale at some point. Mm-hmm. But when you get to a certain place, then you know what you're comfortable with producing. And then you basically limit, instead of, you know, believing that we all need to grow in order to be healthy businesses. You know, maybe you reach a place where somebody drops off your list, you add somebody else on, and you still have the same amount of capacity and you have the same amount of demand mm-hmm. or, you know, business. So we can offer really good stuff for a really fair price. It's not inexpensive by any stretch of the imagination, but we can't produce what we produce and sell it to at wholesale and do honor to our own labor, mm-hmm. much less the value of the product itself, even if we did it for nothing. And so really our whole philosophy, whether it's bread or poultry, or probably even if we were doing some sort of, you know, some other craft work, even would be to build a relationship with the customer and then use that as your sort of risk management tool, as opposed to accepting a lower profit margin, if you will, by going the large quantity route. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the thing that would break my heart the most would be to see unsold chickens or unsold loaves of beautiful sourdough bread mm-hmm. being tossed because they didn't get sold in time or whatnot. I mean, Karen, a lot of folks ask Karen, you know, when are you going to open up a bakery? And she always says, you know, I have no plans to do that because now I have overhead and mm-hmm. now every right. day I have, yeah. And then every day she has to bake on speculation. And, you know, it may not, you know, we may not retire on it, you know, it may not be as big or as financially lucrative as some other business model could be, but it's one that provides steady, ready cash flow and that works for us in terms of our you know, anxiety levels mm-hmm. and financial risk sort of taking comfort zones.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's what you said. I mean, it's, you do lower the risk, so then you don't have to worry about it. And we had talked about that in our business back in Ohio when we were filming weddings, because we were getting to the point where we were turning down as many weddings as we were booking because we were already yep. booked for the days. And we kind of hit a point where, okay, do you start to hire people and do you
right.
start to grow that way? Or, you know, can you just be happy with where you're at? And I had a lot of friends who would go out and do that and grow it sort of horizontally, I guess you could say, where right. they would hire people and get a studio or get a meeting space and this and that and this and that. But that, you know, you're not really bringing home any more money at the end of the day. You're just paying for your office space or paying for your, you know, if it's a storefront and for your employees, and then you have to pay benefits or whatever
exactly.
else. So it doesn't really add to your pocketbook at the end of the day. It just adds to your headaches.
Yeah, certainly. And certainly can turn out that way for mm-hmm. sure.
And and there are ways obviously to do it right. successfully, but right. I guess it comes down to, what is your goal? You know, what's at the end of the day, what do you want to be doing? Do you want to be the person baking the bread, or do you want to be the person managing the other five people baking the bread?
Exactly. And that's what Karen says all the time. She says it exactly that way. And you know, a big chunk of her joy is her putting her love and soul into everything that she bakes. And she, you know, it's not even a control thing. It's strictly that it's not the same if she's managing people who have been indoctrinated on her process. You know, mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Exactly. And one of the things I love, too, about keeping things small, and we talked about this when we did an episode on local food, and one of the things I find the greatest about this kind of thing, like cottage industry and keeping things small and home-based, is that the food then becomes part of the community, and you build a community around it, as opposed to going to the grocery store and not having any idea who it was that made that loaf of bread. I think that connection is really almost more valuable than the product itself, because in our procurement of local food, like our dairy farmers, we've become really good friends with them, you know, through the course of getting, we started out getting eggs from them and they became our raw dairy after that. And we got milk from them. And some of the relationships we've built with our farmers and the people that produced some of our food and, you know, the guy that roasted our coffee, you know, and all of those things have just been, I mean, I can't imagine our lives without some of those people that we've met through some of those interesting little home-based businesses that we've supported through the years.
Yeah, I think the community component is huge, and I was even just going to mention that, you know, and if we're out of you know, pigs, or we're out of sheep, we have friends that we'll just send you know those potential customers off to, and we all do that. We all refer, you know, new folks to one another to see if somebody can fit them into their schedule. Mm-hmm. And it works great because if I'm out of eggs and somebody needs eggs, we can find them eggs, but they make the bargain with that other person. You know, we don't broker one another's stuff. And then, you know what I mean? I just like that, the way it works, because as you say, we get to know one another. We have a relationship with members in our community, and I think that's huge added value to the whole process.
Mm-hmm. And I always told people too, it's almost like insurance. You know, everybody has to buy insurance for everything now, because we no longer have communities of people mm-hmm. to support us when things go wrong. And I knew back in Ohio, because we had developed like this kind of local food ecosystem where we acquired all of our food from people who we knew. Mm-hmm. Like if we had both lost our jobs or something horrible had happened, I wouldn't have to worry about not being able to buy milk, because I know that Mike and Don would have gladly given us milk for as long as we needed it. And we would have gladly done whatever they needed help with should something have happened to one of them, whether go out and help on the farm or do whatever we could in that respect too. So, I mean, that's another huge benefit.
It's totally lost. I mean, it's unfortunately mm-hmm. very lost in our modern society, kind of.
And maybe that's why the idea of homesteading, or of, you know, of all these different things, is coming back around and is becoming mainstream again. It's that people want that back. They want community mm-hmm. back, because we don't have a lot of it anymore. You know, we're all very self-contained and on our phones and on our computers and isolated from one another. And, you know, especially when you live in a city, you know, that even goes up another notch, where you can walk from one place to another and not see anyone that you walk by. And that's one of the reasons we really appreciate where we've moved to in Maine, is that there is definitely a community feeling. Mm-hmm. You know, people in the community are involved in each other's lives in a good way. So yeah, maybe that's why it is becoming popular. It's not just that people want to grow their own food, but they want to know the people that are growing it, you mm-hmm. know, and that's definitely a good benefit. So is there anything else you want to mention about the book that we haven't covered so far?
Oh gosh, you know, we've been all over the place, haven't we? You know, I can't really, I can't think of too much. You know, I did want to just make one mention on the chapter in there on doing the kitchen.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
There's a whole chapter on giving your kitchen a makeover, kind of on the sly or on the cheap. And that's something that I would love to encourage folks to do. You know, if, the kitchen is sort of the heartbeat, at least of many homes. Mm-hmm. Certainly it is ours. It's the heart and the soul of it. And, you know, I was batching it, you know, for a while, and it was sort of like, I thought it was fine. <You know? laughs> But it's, and I look at pictures now, and it was, you know, the dark old 70s vintage plywood paneling and whatnot. And yet neither Karen nor I were inclined to, you know, buy new cabinets. These mm-hmm. things had been built in. They were deeper than what yeah. you can get today. And so we put our heads together, and, you know, she figured out a way to paint them, and I figured out a way to sort of detail them so that they looked more like they were made out of planks. Mm-hmm. And I'm not beating my chest on this. I'm just saying, you know, take your time. You might look at that kitchen and go, God, this place is grungy. I don't want to spend too much time here, but kind of get to know it and look at what you've got, look at what its bones look like, and then just put your heads together and see if there's not a way that you can bring it to the place you need it to be without spending, you know, your retirement
right.
Mm-hmm. to get it to happen.
Yeah. And that's, the pictures are great. I was just looking at that again earlier today because I've been following along the process of your kitchen island.
Yeah, the kitchen island project.
I don't know, however long you've been working on it, because I remember the first post, I think, where you milled some of the lumber and talked about it. But there's always, we did kind of that back in Ohio. We painted our cabinets and routed some cheap wood and made molding, and everybody was amazed at how great the kitchen looked afterwards, and we spent, you know, a couple $100 on it, and that was it.
Yeah, of course, our kitchen now, Hank, if you want to come and do some work on it, that would be great, because it is, I think it's
beyond needing just a coat of paint.
Probably you need to gut it out. Huh?
We're thinking that's probably going to be the
It's unfortunate. I mean, it's, yeah, it, and when I say it's unfortunate, I'm not saying it's unfortunate we have to gut it. I mean, the kitchen is itself unfortunate. but just as a final question then, for this portion of the podcast, I guess we should say, are there any books that come to mind? Because we always do a book of the week whenever we post the podcast, or a couple books of the week.
Because I never have just one book
that
I'm recommending.
And every topic that we talk about, she always has about 10 that she's read on it and so on. So are there any books that come to mind that you really have enjoyed or that have really influenced you over the years that you would recommend that our listeners add to their library?
You know, I can come up with authors probably better than I can come up with titles.
Yeah, that's fine.
You know, I'm a big Shannon Hayes fan. Mm-hmm. She's a farmer in upstate New York, I think, or maybe it's mid-state, whatever you would call it. You know, you can learn a lot about meat and animal husbandry and sort of life outlook from her, and some awesome recipes. Of course, you know, I'm a big fan of Wendell Berry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, get some sort of land ethic ideas, perhaps a little bit more sort of agrarian spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, why might you want to do it this way? You know, certainly I've enjoyed Joel Salatin's books over the years. Just, I think, his irreverence to the mainstream. You know, it's like, it doesn't have to be this way. And
he's the ultimate, like, avoiding, not letting the rules handicap your progress.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And thankfully now he's got financial resources to prove it, to basically tell the USDA to shove it on occasion.
Right. Yep.
And I'm, you know, that just makes me chuckle. It's not because I dislike everybody at the USDA or anything like that, but bureaucracy sometimes is just, it just needs to be told that occasionally.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So definitely those folks. Gene Logsdon, mm-hmm. you know, he's funny.
He's great.
Anybody that's at all interested in small grains,
mm-hmm.
You know, growing your own wheats and spelts and threshing and grinding and that kind of stuff. And he's got a couple of novels out there too, which I've just really enjoyed. I and I'm sorry, I can't think. One of them is, I think my favorite of his novels is The Last of the Husbandmen.
Mm-hmm.
The Last of the Husbandmen, and it's really about some family members. I mean, it's fictionalized, but who were true animal husbands. They you know, didn't cotton to the convert everything to a confinement and all of that, because it took the joy out of doing the work and it took the joy out of the animals' lives. So lots of those kinds of things. Of course, Carla Emery's you know, a homesteading guide, which I think is still in print in some form or another, is a great one to just sort of open it up to any page and just see what you learn from reading it. And there are certainly others too.
So do you guys have any other plans for future books that you and Karen are going to write, or?
Oh, you know, one never knows. I think I'm sure we both have probably a few more in us, but we've got no proposals on the table.
Okay.
We've had brief Sunday morning discussions on what we should try to do next over coffee, but we really haven't gotten anywhere near the place of putting a proposal together. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling, you know, I'm working on a shepherd's wagon right now in my shop, and I've been documenting that. I think I might want to do something on that. She'll probably build the interior or do a lot of the interior, but I don't know if there's a market for that. You know, maybe maybe something along those lines, or maybe I'll do something along the lines of, you know, growing and maintaining old corns or something. I don't know. You know, so it's we've kicked some things around, but once you finish one and one comes out, you know, it doesn't take that a book. I mean, your mind doesn't take too long to start going to, what should we do now?
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Of course, we're coming into the growing season, so you're not going to have any time to do anything. So
no, this is good, because
we always joke about the stats on the blog, how they fluctuate between the different seasons, and as soon as the weather turns nice, you see, you know, numbers drop off. So it's interesting. And just to let our listeners know, we are going to be giving away a copy of your book, and from what I hear, you're going to be signing it. So so that's
Karen and I will both sign it. Yep,
that's great. So typically we come up with something, because we don't like to we like to make it kind of exclusive as to who can get the book. And so what we do is we always insert something in the podcast so the general blog readers don't know what's going on.
Yeah, it's like a secret code, secret word that they have to mention in their comment.
Interesting.
Yeah, so let's think of something. What would be good for this one for everybody to mention in their, we said pigs. What did we do the last time?
Chickens.
Oh, yeah, it was chickens. It was how many, or the most interesting word that you can come up with for chickens, or...
Or incorporating chicken into your comment.
Into your comment, the word chicken. Awesome. or a variation of chicken. So maybe we should do pigs this time, since it's playing with pigs.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
I love it.
So, yeah, you should actually... I'll have to send you a link.
The
comments were hilarious.
Oh, I can't wait.
Oh, it was great. So yeah, if you want to get a copy of Hank's book, Plowing with Pigs, leave a comment in the show notes, and you can do that at cultivatesimple.com. And you have to incorporate the word pigs, or we'll go with the most creative.
Yeah, you could use bacon.
Bacon, any sort of pig product or
reference
variation of pig. Swine.
And please keep it clean.
Yes.
Because we had a borderline one with the chicken.
Yes.
Oh, Lordy. Yes.
This is a family show.
There was one we almost had to delete. It was right on the edge, but we let it slide. So a couple other things we do on the show, Hank, we always have a What's for Dinner segment where Susie talks about what we're... usually we record this on Sunday
right
after dinner. And so we talk about what we had for dinner. So do you... What'd you have for dinner last night?
Oh, gosh. You wouldn't believe what we had for dinner last night. It was the most gorgeous sort of quinoa dish on the side. I remember that. It was quinoa and garlic, and then with some butter and olive oil on it. How bad could it be?
Of course.
And then Karen had found a beautiful piece of cod, mm-hmm. and she crusted it with some of her breadcrumbs and butter and garlic. I thought I'd die. To quote the local folks around here, I thought I died and went to heaven. yeah, and it didn't come out. I mean, it didn't really come out of our freezer, unfortunately. But that's what we had last night, and in fact, it's making me making my mouth water right now, and I know there's no leftovers.
That's one thing I like about Susie is that she always overcooks and not in
so
many...
we have leftovers.
Yes. Yeah. She always cooks way too much. And we actually went to what we had for dinner last night. We went to a party on
Saturday,
a housewarming party. And Susie made meat. Well, why don't you tell them about
it? I made meatballs, but they were venison meatballs, just plain venison. And I put some sage and savory and marjoram in them to give them like a kind of a sausagey flavor.
Yes.
Then I cooked them in some of my roasted tomato passata that I make and can in the fall. And then I made some semolina bread, like some rolls to eat them on. And we got some good provolone cheese at our little local German deli right down the street. And then
Are
we had a home harvested salad. I planted lettuce in little pots and we keep it in front of our windows. And so we can have a salad or two a week all winter long that we grow ourselves. So we had a salad and with Meyer lemon vinaigrette. I bought lemons from Lemon Ladies Orchard in California.
California.
I know. I buy a box of lemons from her every year. It was tasty.
Yeah.
Oh, it sounds awesome.
And that was leftovers. Oh, yeah. I love leftovers.
Things like meatballs and lasagna are always better the next day.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I agree totally. And I am a total meatball hound. Oh.
Well, that's...
killing me.
I know. I told her, which I always have to be careful when I compliment Susie because sometimes she doesn't take the compliment the way I intend it to be. And there was this meatball or this Italian, it's a pizza joint and a sub shop back in the town that I grew up in. And they made just... And I don't know if it's the memory of it or if the subs were actually this good, but they made a meatball sub that was just out of this world. And yeah, on Saturday night when I had one of her subs, I said, this is as good or better than the Sandwich Factory. And I said, I know that you're going to take this the wrong way,
of course, here it comes.
Which then, of course, she proceeded to tell everyone how I always say, whenever she says, oh, so how do you like it? And I say, oh, it's not bad.
It's not bad.
Of course, when she tells it, she's
not
like,
bad.
Oh,
it's not a compliment.
Not bad. See, to me,
that's like a negative compliment.
Not bad is about as emotional as we used to get when I was a kid. Not bad was about as good as it could be.
Exactly.
That's what it meant.
I mean, that's the pinnacle of that's the pinnacle of good is not bad.
It really means awesome. But yeah, you weren't allowed to say that.
If you're looking on a scale, you've got good and bad, and not bad would be on the good side. But I can never win. So another thing that we do on the show is that we always it always seems like whenever people are telling you about what's going on around their homestead or what they're doing, it's always the good things, and I think it gives a kind of a skewed
rosy
view.
Glow.
Yeah, totally. The bucolic homestead. So we always have the fail of the week, which we always try to share something that
went
that,
completely wrong
that happened this past week that just went completely pear-shaped and turned out to be awful. So do you have anything from in for you? It doesn't have to be the past. Oh, you do?
Good.
What was your fail of the week?
We lost one of our favorite ewes. Mm-hmm. She was 4 years old. I'm quite certain she had triplets, and she managed to squeeze two out, both really tightly wrapped in their sacks. And an hour later, she was dead.
Really?
and it breaks your heart. Mm-hmm. And I think I know what I did. I fed her too much. I mean, her winter, you know, she always got something a little extra, you know, and because it made me feel good. Mm-hmm. And pretty sure I made it so that her babes were too big, and gosh, I still feel horrible about it. And it's, you know, it's one of those things that happen occasionally. Yeah,
definitely. Mm-hmm. And we just talked about that a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm.
But it's always good to talk about that because you should always learn. We talked in one podcast about how failure is almost more important than success because you learn. Totally. You can learn so much more from it as long as you take ownership of it and think through what went wrong and what may have caused it and figure out what you can do in the future. Because sometimes you don't know why you succeed, but generally right. You can figure out exactly why something failed and you know not to do that again.
Yep, I agree. I agree totally.
So if people want to find out more about you or follow what you're doing or Grit Magazine or the book, where can people find the book? Where can people find out more about you?
Folks can get an autographed copy, autographed by both Karen and me, if they order it at grit.com. Mm-hmm. And they would have to navigate through the shopping tab or whatever, mm-hmm. but they could certainly find it. But otherwise, it's available, you know, at your local bookseller or through that establishment, mm-hmm. or Amazon.com, you name it. Mm-hmm. And, if, you know, you can, I don't get a blog out very often anymore, but I do have a blog that shows up on the Grit homepage, grit.com. And you can always send me an email. I'm pretty good about getting back. Mm-hmm. to folks via email, and it's hwill@grit.com. So lots of different ways to try to
and you
keep
can
tabs
follow
on me or
Grit
whatever.
On Facebook because you're you post a lot of stuff on Grit. I noticed earlier this week you were posting about burning your pastures and your plant. You talked about you showed pictures about your social corn and all of that kind of stuff. So,
That's another good way to kind of
definitely follow Grit on Facebook to keep up with all of that good stuff.
And watch the TV show Tough Grit, right?
Oh yeah, Tough Grit, and Tough Grit has its own Facebook page as well, right. Tough Grit. But and that runs, I believe, through June.
Okay. Yeah, and you can watch the episodes at toughgrit.com. The most recent episode.
Although we'll
is on
warn
the,
you that because we do this podcast without ads, and that's one of our big big things because we don't want people to feel like we're your thing. I'm talking about the TV show because we don't want people to feel like we're shilling for a company or for certain products.
No.
And so we'll warn you.
No,
that,
and
that,
I can
that,
say that you're not.
That TV show is not like that. They definitely are wanting you to buy stuff at TSC. So just a warning for our for our listeners.
No, it's almost a, what do they call them?
It's like an infomercial.
Infomercial. Yeah. Thank you.
So,
thank
but
you.
Maybe when they watch that, they'll realize how valuable this podcast is in my blog because I don't have ads and then maybe they'll go donate.
which is a good segue because every week I beg for money. So if you do want to support this podcast or the blog.
Because we are a reader and a listener supported, that way I don't have to talk about Roundup like Hank had to talk about on Tough Grit a couple weeks ago.
Oh, you know how hard that was?
Oh, man. I when we were watching that, I said, I bet his skin is just crawling right now.
And it wasn't Roundup, though. It was like their brand, right?
Well, I noticed but you never actually said... You said it in such a subtle way that it wasn't... You never actually mentioned the product, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Talking about labels. I said the only way I'm going to have this thing in my shot is if I'm talking about the label.
Uh-huh. That's right. So, and I have to be honest, and I think I told you this via Facebook, but I mean no disrespect to your co-hosts and to the other people on the show, but you're really awesome on that show.
She was.
you seem so calm and real, I guess is a good good word to So if you want to see Hank and his awesome beard, watch Tough Grit.
You guys are too kind.
I've seen poultry living in that beard, so I
saw a duck in that beard on Facebook. I think it was last week.
There's no telling what kind of woodland animals are living in there. So
you never know. You just never know what might pop out of there.
Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast today, and we hope to talk to you again soon. You're welcome back anytime.
Well, thank you. You guys are an inspiration, and it's been an honor for me to spend time with you today.
I'd rather be a farmer. I'd rather work the land. I'd rather see the mountainsides. I'd rather see your hand. I'd rather swim the ocean. I'd rather not pretend. I'd rather do some thinking now. But somehow it all depends. If I could fly away from me, to ride this wind above the tree. I'd rather see my hometown. I'd rather hold my wife. I'd rather never question things. That's the story of my life. I'd rather not be crying. I'd rather just be whole. I'd rather brave the cleansing fire. I'd rather feed my soul. If I could fly away from me, to ride this wind above the tree. Open to suggestions. I'm crying out to you. I'm ready to be finished here. I'm ready for this season to be if I could fly away from me, to ride this wind above the trees, and go to come and face the longing.